All right, Sean, Laurel, we have a couple of major Wisconsin Supreme Court cases to discuss this week, and I know you keep telling me how complicated and nuanced they both were, but brevity is the name of the game here in the intro. So here's the deal. You each get 15 seconds to tell me about the case you covered this week.
15 seconds? I mean, we were just telling you how they are complex and nuanced, but look, I'll try anything for the podcast, man, so 15 seconds. I'll give it a go, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can give it a shot.
All right, Sean, you're up first.
Okay.
Clock set?
Yep.
Go.
So the case decided Friday by the Supreme Court was about the governor's partial veto power, which originated in a 1930 amendment to the state constitution and has gradually been strengthened by the state Supreme Court beginning in 1935 and in a series of eight cases.
Matt, you're done.
Dang. Man, that happened really fast. I feel like I failed, guys.
Darn right you did. Laurel, I hope you can do better.
Exactly.
All right. Pull up that timer. Let's do this thing.
All right. Ready? Set? Go.
Okay, so my case was decided on Thursday, and it has to do with some of the lame duck laws that were passed in 2018 by the Republican-controlled legislature. And this lame duck session was held after Governor Evers and the Attorney General, Josh Call, were elected.
Ooh,
but
sorry. Oh. Gosh, you guys are really bad at this.
Look, Mr. Smarty Pants Podcast Man, okay? We told you they were complex. And we gave it a shot, but really, you can't sum these things up in 15 seconds. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, it's not possible, and I would like to see you try, John K. Wilson.
Whatever. Watch me.
Okay.
All right. I would love to see. I am kicking back. I have my popcorn. Let's go.
I'm ready to celebrate your failure.
I'm throwing up the clock, 15 seconds to explain these two cases, and go.
Well, they're two cases about separation of powers. The conservative-leaning Supreme Court ruled in favor of Republican lawmakers and against a Democratic governor.
14.3 seconds.
Fine, you know. Good job, John. But the beauty in analyzing Supreme Court cases is in looking at the nuance, the complexities.
Really the soul of each case. You're just glossing over the details there, John. Sure, that's the major takeaway. But where's the heart?
Well, let's spend the next 20 to 30 minutes talking about it. This is the WPR Politics Podcast. I'm John K. Wilson.
I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Laurel White.
This week, we talk about what the Supreme Court had to say about all that power. No one meant to have all that power. The clock's ticking, I just count the hours. Stop chipping, I'm chipping off the power. Peel in, up at the world's hours. And that, of course, is the song Power from hip-hop recording artist turned sneaker impresario and presidential candidate Kanye West from his studio album from 2010, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. You know, obviously he's in the news this week announcing his presidential campaign, but also I really feel like that song is really sort of prescient too. You know, it could have been written by the Wisconsin Supreme Court about Tony Evers and Josh Call.
Wow. I feel like you're just reinforcing that you viewed this all as a separation of powers dispute, like one larger question. So hats off to you, John. Now we're going to bring some nuances that are going to knock your freaking socks off.
I also feel like you're just trying to show off your vocabulary. Impresario, prescient. Come on. Yeah. That's a lot this early in the podcast, I feel like.
Someone works the Times crossword puzzle.
It's true. I do. And also, I'm not wearing any socks.
Mission accomplished. You must have read our stories.
Which one of these cases do we want to get to first?
Well, we'll go me for the random reason that I went first in the intro. So stay tuned for Laurel's action-packed breakdown of the lame duck decision coming up later in this podcast. We will start with the Supreme Court's decision in the partial veto case, which the Supreme Court has weighed in on a lot in the last 85 years, John and Laurel. There's some pretty fascinating histories out there, especially one by the Legislative Reference Bureau that talks through every case that's ever been decided about the partial vetoes. And generally speaking, since 1935, the Supreme Court has said, hey, we didn't make the rules. The public approved this partial veto for the governor, and the partial veto has these powers. And so the court has strengthened the partial veto power of Wisconsin governors over the years. And what you had in this case was justices weakened that power, but it was very jumbled in the way that they did it. And I have no idea what it's going to mean for future cases in terms of like where to draw the line over where a veto is okay and where it's not.
So I know you want to talk about that jumble. I can feel it. You're raring to go because it was very jumbled. But just real quick, can you break down what the case was about?
So the case on its surface was, actually there were a couple cases. One was brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and it challenged four vetoes that Governor Tony Evers made in his 2019 state budget. The other case was brought by Wisconsin Small Business Inc., which challenged two vetoes made by Republican Governor Scott Walker in the 2017 budget. The court basically said with the small business claim, they took too long to raise that issue, you know, so they just didn't deal with it. The Small Business Inc. Lawsuit was about this. One of the vetoes where Governor Walker changed an effective date and like extended it by 1,000 years, which is,
that's
something. I don't know what's going to be happening in 1,000 years. The other, though, the case that really we're going to talk about today, because the court kind of passed on that case, was the case brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And so on its surface, Will was challenging these four vetoes, but they were also inviting the court to revisit previous court decisions on this, going back to 1935, essentially saying that the rationale that the court had used over all these decades, 85 years, was wrong. You know, that through the courts, the governor had, and through governors' actions themselves, governors had kind of taken on more of this power of lawmaking, which is reserved for the legislature, and that it was the court's duty to correct that. So they sort of served it up. Like, here, it's kind of about these four vetoes, but really, here's the issue. It's in your, air quotes, court now, justices.
You know,
do what you,
Sean,
will.
Of course, that was a very accurate summary of those cases. We would expect nothing less from you. But I feel like it's really remiss of you to not mention the snazzy nickname for the veto that they were talking about in the Will case, because we know that the podcast listeners love this. Or at least I do. I don't know.
We know that Laurel loves the fancy names.
I love the snazzy veto nicknames. As people that are familiar with the podcast know, we've got the Vanna White veto, taking out letters to make new words. We've got the Frankenstein veto, taking out parts of sentences to make new sentences.
And those have both been prohibited by voters in a 1990 and a 2008 constitutional amendment. So voters said, you can't Vanna White and Frankenstein anymore, governors. Go on,
exactly.
Laurel.
Exactly. And in this case, the Will case, they were talking about the magician's veto, which is basically taking, you know, something passed by the legislature and waving a magic wand over it, or a veto pen, a magic veto pen, and changing it so substantially that basically the legislative intent goes away. So good summary, but you got to mention the snazzy name.
Yeah, I understand. You're right.
So what did the court end up deciding here?
Okay.
And this is where we can get into the, nuance, as it were.
So set your timer for 15 minutes, John. No, okay. I think we can really try to break this down concisely, okay? The bottom line is that the court did strike down three of Governor Tony Evers' vetoes. So that included one that shifted funding for school buses to electric vehicle charging stations, included a veto that changed the definition of vapor products, and it included a veto that redefined who qualified for funding under a local roads improvement fund. They did not strike down another veto that kind of reconfigured a fee on heavy trucks. So they struck down three. They didn't strike down the fourth. But I think the way that they did it is pretty interesting, because if you kind of break it down, you know, you look for, you had a majority of the court say that those vetoes should go away, but a majority of the court could not agree on why. So in terms of the why, there were three decisions on the why, and then one decision that said, no, you should have left it all in place. So you had as you're reading through the decision, you have a decision by Chief Justice Patience Rogensack talking about, you know, why these vetoes kind of crossed the line. She said that a governor's veto must not alter the stated legislative idea behind a bill. She was not joined in her opinion by anybody, meaning, you know, while they reached the same conclusion, nobody said, Justice Rogensack, you got the rationale right. So then there was this other opinion written by Justice Brian Hagedorn, former chief legal counsel to Governor Walker. So very familiar with kind of the way that vetoes can be used by a governor to rewrite laws effectively. He said that the governor should be banned from selectively editing parts of a bill to create a new policy that was not proposed by the legislature. But he acknowledged that this issue was not settled. He was joined in his opinion by Justice Annette Ziegler, but nobody else. Okay, so there's, for those keeping track of score at home, that's one for Rogensack, two for Justice Hagedorn, and then Justice Kelly wrote an opinion. These are all conservative justices that I've mentioned so far. He was joined by Justice Rebecca Bradley. They're both Walker appointees to the court. And they had what I would say was the most sweeping, I guess, scornful, you know, opinion about how the partial veto has grown since it was adopted in 1930. And he sort of starts his opinion by saying, look, the legislature makes laws. That's how it works. We're going to start from there. And anything else that doesn't follow, it's our duty as the court to strike down. He says, and again, this is one of those that I always recommend reading the footnotes in these Supreme Court decisions, because that's where the justices kind of take shots at each other, give you some of the spiciest quotes. He says, quote, it is an embarrassment, not a source of authority, that our court has never honored the Constitution's limitations on the partial veto. Perpetuating an embarrassment is not a judicial doctrine to which I subscribe. So, bringing some serious heat there, but he only gets one justice to join his rationale, which would have wiped out all of the vetoes and essentially gone back to a very limited gubernatorial veto power. He gets Justice Rebecca Bradley to join him, but nobody else. So that's where the majority lies, John. Does that make You see what all happened there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the two liberal justices were the final two who said we shouldn't wipe out any of these vetoes.
Yeah, and this was Justice Anne Walsh Bradley and Justice Rebecca Dallet. Anne Walsh Bradley wrote the dissenting opinion, and she said that she had a very quotable opinion. You know, some opinions are just laying them out there for you, and this was one of those. She said, without a clear rule, how will future courts know how to apply this law? They won't. She answered her own question there. You got that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I could do a more dramatic reading of this.
Sometimes
I could do a more dramatic reading. And she goes on, how can governors be assured that the partial veto they are crafting is constitutional? They can't. Another answer to her question. There's a lot of that in her opinion, essentially saying that they had created this jumbled mess. You know, she says, quote, in an important case like this, where the people of Wisconsin need clarity, we instead sow confusion. So she's saying this court has ruled on this. It's been clear. And the people chose the word partial veto instead of item veto back in 1930. They had an option to say item veto. They went with partial. And so the people of the state of Wisconsin, you know, for better or for worse, have given the governor this kind of special power. And it's not up to the court, in her mind, to decide that it was a bad idea.
So, I mean, it was kind of my understanding after reading about this was that a lot of even the justices in the opinion, I think Justice Hagedorn wrote this too, that basically there are just going to be more lawsuits about partial vetoes.
Yeah,
his
direct quote, you're right. I mean, his direct quote is, quote, future litigation will surely provide opportunities to refine the analysis. So, yes, a very clear acknowledgement that this is like not decided law when it comes to future governor vetoes.
And so that's part of it in terms of the future of, you know, where jurisprudence might go on this case and, you know, the potential of future lawsuits and stuff. But what happens going forward in terms of these actual vetoes that were struck down? I mean, because this budget is already in effect at this point.
So that's interesting because I think my understanding is that the majority considers these vetoes to be rescinded. And so in effect that whatever the legislature sent to the governor's desk, it's my understanding, is now law. I don't know what mechanically, like what that means in terms of the state budget, because the governor's statement was, you know, more or less that this creates chaos and upends precedent. But, you know, it's not going to stop me from doing budgets for the people, et cetera. So I don't know what it means in terms of the actual budget, which we are now in, but, you know, I do think that these specific things have now been returned to the way that they were sent to the governor's desk.
Well, we've spent a fair amount of time talking about Sean's case now. Do we want to switch gears to Laurel's complex, nuanced case?
Yeah, let's do it. We've had our decent opening act. Now it's time to hear about the real case.
Ooh.
I vamped for the crowd. And now the main event, Laurel White.
The lame duck case, of which there are many, and this is one.
Yeah, so what was it all about?
So this case was about the lame duck session that was in December 2018, happened after Governor Evers and the Attorney General, Josh Call, were elected, but before they took office. And some of the laws passed during that lame duck session rolled back some specific powers that the governor and the attorney general, the executive branch, have exercised historically in Wisconsin. Some specific things that we've talked about, you know, the power for the governor to leave federal lawsuits. That was a huge thing that we talked about during the campaign, seeking federal waivers. We've talked a lot about the attorney general's power to settle lawsuits. Those are things that the lame duck session took away from them. Now, we'll get into this a little bit more later, this particular argument and this particular decision before the Supreme Court didn't address all of the laws in the lame duck session. I can talk more about which specific laws it addressed in a bit, but that was kind of the overarching thing. A union group brought this lawsuit saying that some of the laws passed violate the executive power and violate the separation of powers in the state constitution.
And what did the court have to say about that?
So much like Sean's case, it was kind of a complicated ruling with some justices going off on their own and kind of some unlikely coalitions. I actually have a handy dandy notepad here that looks like a little bit like kind of a beautiful mind, kind of arrows and groups and names and everything when I was trying to keep track of who ruled with who and who agreed on what and what subjects they were about. So
no big deal. Laurel's just describing herself as a genius in case you missed that humble brag. I have so many thoughts that
I
sometimes
yeah.
see lines and arrows in space to connect them.
Yeah, or I needed to visually group all the names together so I could understand.
On my notebook, it's literally just like 10 games of tic-tac-toe with myself. Draw every time.
So I think the big parts of this case that were decided, the two big takeaways had to do with the Attorney General's power to settle lawsuits and sort of the legislature's ability to involve itself in legal actions that are related to the state, the legislature's power to kind of have their own lawyers if they want to represent them in challenges. And in that element of this lawsuit, in that particular set of laws from the lame duck session, the court ruled in its pretty familiar to us partisan division of 5-2. So the court's conservative justices agreed that those laws should stay in place, and the court's two liberals threw them out. And essentially what they said in the decision, the majority decision, was that the legislature has a vested interest in some of in these lawsuits, and it's a reasonable one. It's a place where there's kind of an overlap in the branches of government, and so it's not an exclusive power of the executive branch. It's a shared power to kind of interact with these lawsuits. One of the things that they said is that the legislature is sometimes a party in these lawsuits, so of course they have an interest there. The other thing they said is some of these lawsuits have to do with state finances. And so because the legislature has the quote-unquote power of the purse in the state, they can be a part of that kind of legal maneuvering. So that's how that particular part shook out. And that happened to the advantage of Republicans in the legislature. The other part didn't go their way. The court actually ruled to strike down one of the lame duck laws, and that had to do with guidance documents, which I'm sure we're all very familiar with, right? You guys know what guidance documents are.
Totally, but just pretend that I don't, you know? I'm a listener who's not sure what a guidance document from the executive branch is.
Yeah, it's right. Just like best practices. Like, obviously, everybody knows. We were
sure.
Sure.
I just wrote a guidance document just now, but...
Yeah, but just...
But pretend that we don't do this in our daily lives.
Basically, it's any kind of public document written by a state department that explains laws. So a pamphlet, an informational booklet, a handout, something that comes from a state department, just explaining things to people, relevant laws that are relevant to their department. Or, you know, kind of, these are the guidelines, these are the rules of the road, etc. So under this lame duck law... the administration would have had to approve or get some approvals of these guidance documents from the legislature. There would have been more of kind of a process to go through before these documents could be made public. And in its decision, the court said that that really did go too far, that it's the purview of the executive to make sure that laws are executed correctly. That's kind of their fundamental power, right? And these guidance documents and informing the public about the execution of laws is rightfully a core power and something that the legislature shouldn't be involved in. And this was not a 5-2 decision. This was actually kind of a unique coalition of liberal and conservative justices. The decision was written by Justice Daniel Kelly, a conservative. Justice Rebecca Bradley joined him, another conservative. And then the court's two liberal justices, Ann Walsh Bradley and Rebecca Dallet, signed on as well. And there were some really good quotes. Sean was talking about quotes earlier in decisions. And I think this one from Kelly was really good. So he said, quote, "Capturing the executive's ability to communicate his knowledge, intentions, and understanding of the laws he is to execute makes him a drone without the energy or wherewithal to act as a co-equal member of government."
Justice Kelly going out with a bang on these quotes, right?
Right. So, pretty hot fire there. And an interesting, you guys never thought that we'd be looking so closely at guidance documents, but it's happened.
I mean, we probably thought so. You know, that's a really interesting coalition, though. You know, that's, we tend to just sort of lump together the five conservative justices and the two liberals. But if you were to split out that conservative block, the two justices that you just listed there who agreed with the liberals are the two Walker appointees who are most likely to kind of bang the drum in the name of like the founders and textualism and, you know, the way that the state and the Constitution was originally envisioned. Justice Kelly and Rebecca Bradley, that's kind of their thing. And here they are on the same page as the liberals on this issue when it comes to, you know, the split between the executive and the legislative. You don't see it every day.
So in Sean's case, the response from the governor was that it created chaos. What did we hear from the administration when this ruling came down?
So what the governor said was just kind of reiterating what we've heard from him a lot since he's been in office, which is just that Republicans have consistently tried to take power away from him and have been, in this particular statement, he called them sour grapes, and not really accepting the outcome of the 2018 election. So he just kind of reiterated that. I thought what was interesting, because this was really more of a negative decision for the Attorney General. I mean, it upheld the legislature's ability to step in and say when the state can settle lawsuits. That's something that the Attorney General used to have kind of exclusive purview over, you know, allows the legislature to have different representation if it wants to in lawsuits. His response was that he thinks that there are going to be more legal challenges to this. The way that this case was argued was what's called a facial challenge. So it looked really broadly at all of the applications of these laws. And that's a pretty high bar legally to meet. Instead, the Attorney General said, if we look at this on kind of a case-by-case basis, what's called an as-applied basis, there are going to be specific cases, he says, where it's going to be found unconstitutional for the legislature to be involved. And he believes that those legal challenges are coming, and that's something that we're going to, you know, be talking about for a while.
Well, I think we have managed to have a nice broad discussion about separation of powers, as well as getting into some of the complexity and nuance of this week's Supreme Court decisions. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief.
Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Reporter.
Whether you listen to the first 15 seconds, the first 15 minutes, or the whole darn thing, I mean, we can't really tell. You can get new episodes of the WPR Politics Podcast delivered to you almost every single week when you subscribe. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast apps. While you're there, leave a rating or review of the show to help other people find it. And of course, you can catch up on all of our past episodes anytime you'd like at wpr.org/politics. Till then, hope that the world